What's up, NBA fans? It's Danny Green here. For those who want an inside look at the league through the eyes of a three-time champion, check out my podcast, Inside the Green Room. New episodes drop every week. Be sure to subscribe to Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Trump administration has been moving at a lightning pace on a number of different fronts, and here to talk to us about it is Dr. Ali Bustamante, UNO Professor, Department of Economics and Finance, and Director of the Division of Business and Economic Research. Dr. Bustamante, welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. I want to start out with Doge. This seems to be something that's like a complete revelation to folks that we would have a look-see to see whether or not our federal government, the bureaucracy, is appropriately sized. And I've been really shocked by some of the reaction to just the possibility of looking at that and revealing, I think, the underbelly of the bureaucracy. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, we actually have, you know, congressional oversight committees, you know, that are whose job and responsibility is certainly to look at not just at government spending, but certainly the actual functioning of government agencies. And this has been something that, you know, is ingrained in the Constitution for, you know, Congress to have that ability to oversee the administrative state. That being said, you know, what we're seeing right now is certainly the executive office driving that kind of oversight in a way that we have never seen before.
But doesn't it speak volumes, though, with some of what they've revealed? If there is this level of congressional oversight, what are they actually looking at? And what is that role? Because some of what's being revealed thus far, I think the public is like in complete total shock that this is what we're doing.
Well, you know, I think it's hard to it's hard to make sense to a lot of the noise. As you mentioned, you know, it's been a breakneck speed at you know, in terms of what DOGE and really the administration's executive orders have really that been pushed through over the past few weeks. It's really a remarkable shift in the way that government has been overseen over the past, hundreds of years. But, you know, in terms of the any potential, government spending that's into question, like I said, so much of this has really the administration is ultimately responsible for what agencies ultimately do and how they allocate their money.
It's interesting, though, and I think a lot of folks are kind of surprised that there's this uncertainty whether or not the executive branch of government actually has the authority to enact, like, you know, a RIF or, you know, layoffs and some of the actions that they're actually taking that look like they're headed to court and they're going to be challenged.
Well, you know, I sent from the vantage point of an economist and not a constitutional scholar. But, you know, one of the things that seems to remain clear is that, you know, a lot of the functioning of the federal government is oftentimes more than anything to fund essential operations and oftentimes even fund, state practices. You know, as a former, chief economist for the Department of Labor here in Louisiana, for the Workforce Commission, you know, I know very well that, you know, our agency very much depends on federal funding. And so it really is, an interesting point of time that we currently have right now in terms of, you know, bringing into question a lot of federal spending.
A lot of folks are saying that some of these actions actually may serve as kind of a shock to the economy. Is the federal bureaucracy that big?
Well, it's not necessarily the federal bureaucracy that's ultimately experiencing these shocks, but it's really markets. So, you know, there's been, as you mentioned, a lot of executive orders, particularly around tariffs, particularly around, whether funding has been withdrawn, withheld or withdrawn from different, grants or other kind of or agencies or, you know, agency layoffs, as you mentioned. And what this basically ultimately does is, again, it really questions the status quo in terms of, you know, what should markets be expecting next? How will, you know, again, not just, you know, what not just what the next move for the administration will be, but certainly how are businesses, how is the business community, how are, you know, trading partners, how do they respond to all of this, to all of these executive actions? And that's really, I think, something that, you know, the Federal Reserve is looking very closely at. You know, in the context of the Federal Reserve, they've been rather clear that, you know, this certainly creates a lot of economic uncertainty that really makes them think twice about continuing further interest rate cuts.
Interesting, though, that we don't tend to look at government in the same way that we look at business, right, where we're looking to see what our ROI, our return on our investment is going to be, whether or not, you know, there's a high efficiency rating, all of the factors and characteristics of a company that the typical Wall Street crowd would look at.
You know, it's a government certainly has a, you know, very different, you know, motive of operation, certainly, you know, by and large, you know, folks should really think about government as, is, you know, what is it actually ultimately providing in terms of services to citizens, right? And I think in that regard, you know, there's always the continuing question of, you know, how do you make government serve the interests of people as best as it can? And that's really something that, you know, again, it's not necessarily the motive, the profit motive of most companies. But that being said, you know, it's, you know, whether how the government actually does its work, it is something that is completely impacting the business community and financial markets, especially.
Yeah. And so goes the way of tariffs as well, right? So we have embarked upon this, I guess, for lack of a better term, I don't know, it looks to me like a tariff warfare at the present time. I don't know who the winner or who the losers are. I suspect it's going to be me as the consumer.
Well, that you're absolutely right about. You know, the number one, the losers for any kind of trade war or you know, or the imposition of tariffs in any way are consumers. You know, when we think about tariffs, you know, they're taxes on imports, right? And so what generally happens is, you know, the producers who are importing goods and services into our country, you know, they pass on those taxes right on the consumers. And oftentimes folks think that, you know, our consumption is just going to shift to domestic firms. But what actually happens more often than not is that these same domestic firms respond to the moment by increasing prices themselves. And so at the end of the day, it's really, the consumer who's ultimately losing out on tariffs.
And that happened. I was speaking with someone yesterday where the aluminum manufacturers and the steel manufacturers in this country immediately jacked up their price on right after the tariffs were put in place.
Absolutely. You know, the tariff, you know, that was recently put in place by the administration of 25% on imports of aluminum and steel, you know, that's something that foreign firms are going to pass on to American producers. But at the same instance, any kind of steel production that's happening in the U.S., you know, they see these price increases on the international level and they, you know, follow up with their own price increases.
How does that influence inflation?
Oh, yeah, wonderful question. You know, when we're thinking about inflation, right, we're thinking about, you know, what's happening with prices and whether it's steel and aluminum today or whether it's, you know, imported goods from other countries, you know, not just the executive orders around tariffs have really, you know, been varied as well, whether you're looking at Canada, Mexico, and also some reciprocal tariffs that the administration is certainly looking into. And all of these things have the potential to really continue to boost up inflation, again, increasing the cost of living for most folks. You know, when even just today, you know, the latest inflation figures were released, and we see that the three biggest drivers of inflation are still, you know, housing, but additionally, food and gasoline are also driving inflation right now.
When we think about, and I've always been very curious about this trade balance and what it actually means to us, because it seems as though a lot of the remedial measures, some of which we just talked about, whether it's tariffs or otherwise, don't really, it's not necessarily helping us. So before it's all said and done, how important in your mind is that trade balance issue?
you know, when we think about the trade balance, you know, in the ideal circumstance, we would have, you know, a lot more open trade. You know, as I kind of mentioned, you know, the trade balance is something that happens at the, you know, that happens certainly at the accounting side of our fiscal state. And, you know, when we think about something like tariffs, that's money that is coming in terms of revenue to the federal government. Now, you know, who ultimately is paying that kind of that revenue? Unfortunately, the dollar stops at consumers, and that's really where, you know, whether we think about trade, whether we think about just the general state of inflation right now. Right now, we're really in a place where consumers are really feeling the pinch.
So when we look at, and this is reported on extensively, there's not a day go by where you don't see the ticker, right, on the national debt. Where are we? Somewhere just north of $36 trillion and growing. I think someone said it was $40 million a minute or something, some crazy number. I can't even quantify what that is. I can't really get my head around what that actually means to us. So you as an economist, if I'm sitting in your economics class, what do you tell me about a $36 trillion debt?
When you look at the, you know, at the national debt, what you're basically looking at is the, you know, the check after a meal, basically, so to speak, which is to say, you know, you're looking at the total that's due for all the spending that's occurred in past fiscal years. And so it doesn't really reflect what's actually being spent at the moment. That's ultimately reflected in treasuries and bonds. Instead, when we look at the national debt, that's really an accrual of all the spending that's happened in past years, past administrations, past generations, in fact. And so much of that debt is constantly paid on an annual basis in the form of interest payments, for the most part, reducing that debt over, you know, trying to attempt to reduce that debt over time. But as you mentioned, you know, when it comes to the federal deficit, when it comes to the national debt, you know, these are things that, you know, markets certainly respond to as well. And so it really, you know, it behooves policymakers to be very mindful about, you know, whether it's a new spending or tax cut, how is that ultimately impacting the debt? Because both of them certainly have the same impact.
Is it safe to say these are borrowed dollars?
It's not necessarily all borrowed dollars per se, but I guess, as I mentioned, you know, it's money that's been spent in the past that ultimately the U.S. government has to decided at one point or another that a certain amount of that spending was going to be issued and was going to be paid for in the form of bonds and treasury notes that would have to be paid back. So a portion of that certainly is borrowed dollars. But again, you know, when that money was borrowed is what really where that national debt is actually coming from.
And not unlike you and I, we buy a car, we finance a car, there's an interest rate that's on there. A lot of people just believe that we print the money so there's really no consequence to us. But that's not true, right?
Well, you know, the consequence is always the value of the international value of the dollar. You know, depending on you know, how secure the international markets ultimately feel that the U.S. dollar is, that's ultimately what's going to where we see the greatest impact of the national debt and the national deficit, whether, you know, people, you know, across the world, whether they want to hold dollars or not, because at the end of the day, you know, if the dollar is strong, that means our purchasing power is strong as consumers as well.
Where does the dollar stand today overall?
Well, actually, right now, the dollar is still actually it's very strong right now. We haven't actually felt a lot of negative impacts, in relation to a lot of the trade, what's happening in the trade markets right now. One of the big reasons why we have such a strong dollar is the fact that we had such a very quick recovery from the pandemic compared to a lot of a lot of countries in Europe and across the world. The fact that we recovered from the pandemic much faster and in a much healthier way really gave us a really strong foundation to have a very strong dollar right now.
When we look at our trade, you know, we went through the years of NAFTA, and then I forgot the acronym that's used after NAFTA, you know, the trade agreement that we have with both Mexico and Canada. it seems as though we have, for a number of years, unwound a lot of those provisions. A lot of what was said was that the power of Mexico, U.S., and Canada as it relates to our trade agreement in the context of the world would make us a lot stronger. Has that proved itself out, or where do we stand with that in your view?
Yeah, you know, the other trade act that you were thinking about in the earlier 2010s was the UMSCA, not necessarily yes. rolls off your tongue like NAFTA does, but yeah. yes. But in terms of both of them really play the same purpose, which is by reducing trade barriers and across these three different countries, the aim was, you know, Mexico and the U.S. are large trading partners. You know, Canada is also a very large trading partner. And so by reducing some of those barriers, perhaps it would stimulate some greater production in the U.S. by being able to source some materials at a lower cost internationally. What we've seen in the aggregate is that, these trade agreements have largely, fueled economic growth. However, it's been certainly at the cost of offshoring some industries and some occupations. But in return, the idea is that by offshoring some of those industries, it's made the overall U.S. economy more resilient.
Yeah. Let me, if you don't mind, I'll go to the text line. A number of folks are asking questions. Won't tariffs on foreign goods boost the demand for American-made goods?
You know, and that's really, again, that's the hope. However, as I kind of mentioned a bit earlier, you know, when international goods become more expensive, even domestic firms see that as an opportunity to raise costs. And so traditionally, domestic firms do not sit idly, as the cheaper good. Instead, they actually see that market conditions have changed, and they really they respond by increasing markups and therefore, leading to consumers to pay overall a higher price, whether they're buying a domestic good or international good.
Another texter asked about the elasticity and or inelasticity of supply and demand on tariff products.
Yeah, and this is where, think about, imposing a 25% tariff on aluminum and steel. You know, there's a lot of industries that would find, the consumption of the consumption of aluminum and steel very inelastic, whether you're talking about car manufacturing, whether you're talking about, John Deere, you name it, Ford. These are companies that are heavily reliant on these kinds of goods. For them, the price, if it increases, it's something that they have to pay and something they have to pay, pass on to consumers. Now, not all industries will be impacted the same by tariffs. Wherever the tariffs are highest and most targeted, that's where we're going to feel the greatest hurt in terms of businesses feeling those inelasticities in their supply chains.
And as you pointed out, the auto manufacturers and John Deere's and alike, they really don't have any place to go, right?
That's right. The U.S. Manufacturing of steel and aluminum is relatively small compared to, Germany's and Japan's. And so, in China's to a certain extent as well. And so it's really about, the level of international competition right now is so high and certainly very ingrained into the way that businesses ultimately do their production.
Right. Dr. Bustamante, thank you so much for joining us today. Truly appreciate your time and your insight trying to make these very complex issues as simplistic as possible. Not always easy, right?
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Have a great week. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870. When we come back, we'll talk about the flu outbreak, the highest in 15 years. Try to find out why. When we return, stay.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
With us. Welcome back, folks. As of February 2025, the United States is experiencing a significant surge in influenza cases, reaching the highest levels in over 15 years. And here to talk to us about it is Dr. David Jantz, Director of Medical Critical Care Services at University Medical Center. He's a doctor at LCMC. Doc, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Doc, I guess simply put, what's going on?
Yeah, this flu season's turned out to be a pretty bad one, both for Louisiana and nationwide. Our flu season here in Louisiana started a little bit earlier than everyone else in the country. We saw flu cases go up in Louisiana starting in early November, and those cases continued to rise here in Louisiana until about early to mid-January. And the rest of the United States is just about a few weeks or a month behind Louisiana. So we've actually been experiencing lots of influenza cases here in Louisiana for a while. And now the rest of the country is just catching up to what we've already been experiencing here in Louisiana. A little bit of hope that I have for us here in Louisiana is that our number of positive flu tests that are coming back in our state hopefully is plateauing. The numbers recently at least aren't continuing to increase, so hopefully we're seeing a plateau and a decrease. And I think that fits, too, with the numbers of hospitalizations that we're seeing in Louisiana, especially in New Orleans, for influenza, where those numbers compared to a month ago, just compared to January, those numbers are also decreasing here in New Orleans of patients that are hospitalized with influenza. But the rest of the country, like I said, is just about a month behind us, and they're certainly experiencing a pretty big surge in influenza cases.
The CDC reports 24 million cases of influenza with 310,000 hospitalizations and 13,000 deaths already, including 57 children. Is there something unique about this strain that's a challenge?
It doesn't seem that like this particular strain is causing some new unique challenge this flu season. The strains that are circulating this flu season, there's two predominant strains, and they happen to be the same strains that have circulated in the past flu seasons in the recent years. So those are the same strains of influenza that are circulating. What is different about this season compared to the past two flu seasons is currently, and we're not even done with this influenza season, but currently we're already nationwide at about the same number of hospitalizations that we were at last year for the entire flu season, and about the same number of nationwide deaths. And like I said, even though Louisiana, my hope is that we're at least plateauing and hopefully on the tail end of this, the rest of the country is still right in the middle of a pretty bad flu season. And we've already hit the number of hospitalizations and deaths that occurred in past seasons. But the particular strain of influenza seems to be causing the same type and same severity of illness, just in a lot more people compared to previous years.
And is there a name for this? I mean, I've heard influenza B, and I don't think this strain, the norovirus, is not what we're talking about, but maybe we'll talk about that in a second.
Craig, this is not norovirus. This is the predominant strains circulating are influenza A, and specifically the H1N1 variant and the H3N2 variant, which thankfully our influenza vaccines this year, they were smart in making that vaccine because they picked those two variants. So the vaccines this year available for influenza include those two variants. which means the vaccines available will likely give us all the best chance to avoid becoming severely ill and avoid dying from influenza.
And it's not too late then to take the shot.
Correct. Within about a week, everyone starts to realize the benefit of that influenza vaccination. And like I said, even though I have some hope that here in Louisiana, we may at least be plateauing with cases and hopefully on the back end, it doesn't mean that the influenza season will be over next week. It still means we probably have at least another month or two of this season with lots of cases, hopefully getting fewer, but that's still plenty of opportunity for people to get sick from influenza. And if you can get your influenza vaccination as soon as possible, it's going to protect you over the next few months where we'll still be experiencing a higher number of cases.
When we experience, visitors from all over the place, we're just coming out of Super Bowl this weekend. We start Mardi Gras already, and that's a, 3 weeks of events. Can that influence, obviously, the spread of this influenza?
Sure, and that's a common story that you hear about respiratory viruses in general. It was actually some fascinating data about COVID. When COVID began in New Orleans around Mardi Gras in 2020, there's some fascinating data about how people who traveled here for that Mardi Gras, how they then influenced spread of COVID in other geographic areas of the country. So that's just a common thing with every respiratory virus and every season of viruses that we have. That's just expected that if you go to a place that has a high incidence of influenza or COVID or RSV, and there's lots of travelers that go to those locations and they go back home where perhaps there's little to none, certainly that can influence the spread of respiratory viruses. So we'll see here, see if there's any clues whether or not the recent Super Bowl has an influence on that. I'm not entirely sure that it will influence it, just because although we've had a lot of people travel in for the Super Bowl, the entire United States is currently experiencing incredibly high rates of influenza. So the rates are already high. I don't think there's an opportunity for someone to travel here and bring it back home, because everywhere home is in the United States right now is experiencing a whole lot of influenza.
Doc, I've been hearing a lot of chatter about a stomach bug. Is that one of the symptoms of this influenza that's going around, or is this something separate?
Influenza, the most common symptoms that influenza causes, this season included, is going to be things like body aches, fevers, chills, can sometimes make you have difficulty breathing. You can have a cough, and you can cough up phlegm, for example, and then get so sick that you need to go to an emergency room or a hospital. This season, we're seeing a little bit more problems with red eyes, where you get, kind of red, tender, sensitive eyes. We see that a little bit more, and sometimes that actually can clue us in as to maybe we should be taking a history about are you exposed to birds, chickens, fresh pet food, et cetera, to try to determine perhaps might that patient be at risk for actually having bird flu or avian influenza, which is a different strain. And then sometimes influenza can cause stomach problems. So, for example, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. It's not the most common thing that occurs when you get influenza. And certainly those stomach issues are way more common with other types of viruses, such as gastrointestinal viruses, like you had mentioned earlier, things like norovirus.
Where do we stand with norovirus? There was a lot of stuff being, bannered about that. What are we seeing in the community?
It still is going around, and norovirus is one of those things that tends to not know seasons as much as influenza does. So there'll be there'll be outbreaks of norovirus that are associated with big events where perhaps, you know, hand washing, et cetera, isn't emphasized, or there's norovirus outbreaks can occur on cruise ships and other scenarios where people are in close quarters and less associated with, you know, it's the winter time. So we saw a fair amount of norovirus a couple months ago. We were seeing a whole lot more norovirus in October, November, December. There's still certainly some going around, and there always will be. But it seems to be less right now in January and February here in New Orleans compared to October, November, when it was causing the most common thing, which is just an illness that causes people to miss work or be out of school with these gastrointestinal type symptoms like nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. But thankfully, less commonly, not always, but less commonly requires a patient to go to an emergency room or need to be hospitalized for it.
One of the things that I've heard about this flu season, especially the cough, people have said that it has taken like 3 to 4 weeks for it to run its course.
Yeah, and that's another thing that is actually pretty common in patients that have gotten influenza, and especially if that influenza caused pneumonia. So influenza is a cause of pneumonia. Doesn't always cause pneumonia in people. Like I said, the most common thing that influenza will cause in the person is you just feel lousy, you feel achy, you have a fever, maybe a little headache. And thankfully, that's as bad as it gets in most people. But sometimes it can cause a person to get pneumonia, where you get a terrible cough and you can have difficulty breathing and you're coughing up phlegm, for example. And certainly in those scenarios, it would be actually somewhat common for people to continue to cough as the weeks go on. So, for example, you feel better, your muscle aches have gone away, your fever has gone away, you feel better in all other regards. But what still lingers is a cough, and that's somewhat common. It's not necessarily something that should alarm people, because that's just a normal way of recovering from a pretty significant respiratory infection that caused pneumonia. And certainly if that cough lingers on the scale of months, then certainly you should be talking to your doctor about it. But on the scale of weeks, especially after a pretty significant influenza infection where it caused things like pneumonia, then that cough that lasts on the scale of weeks is something that we see quite a bit. And I think your experience with it, being that you've heard that from more and more people, I think is not a sign of that's something different this season about influenza, about the strain, but more of a sign of just at how common influenza is this year, that you probably just right. know a lot of people that have been infected with influenza, and then some fraction of those people have then unfortunately gotten a more severe infection, like, for example, gotten a pneumonia with their influenza.
I know that the data comes in after the fact, in last year's flu season, relative to the efficacy of the vaccine, has that data been posted yet? Because you were saying that the strain last year was very similar to the strain this year. The vaccine was also very similar from last year.
Correct. The data for this year, this current season, has not been posted yet. And we'll see over time. The difficulty with those data in Louisiana in particular is that historically in past seasons, those data have also suggested that here in Louisiana, the majority of people don't get the influenza vaccine, and choose not to get it. So, we have, less than half traditionally in the state of Louisiana, of people eligible for the influenza vaccination actually get it. And so back to what we were talking about initially, which is how Louisiana was actually one of the first states to experience this season's influenza surge of cases. That is in part why, because the uptake of that influenza vaccine here in Louisiana just isn't all that good. And then there we have a lot of unvaccinated people. We experience these vaccine preventable respiratory illnesses much sooner than other states. And people that get infected bear the burden of it, and so do all of our healthcare systems.
Yeah. Dr. David Jantz, thank you so much for joining us. Truly appreciate your time and your insight and the update on this flu breakout. Have a great week.
Thank you.
That's Dr. David Jantz, Director of Medical Critical Care Services at University Medical Center, doctor at LCMC. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, you ever dream of riding in a carnival parade? Well, WWL has your tickets to roll with the crew of Argus on Mardi Gras Day. I've done that a dozen times at least. It is a blast. Ride high atop a float with everything you need, costumes, throws for two, all free. Go to WWL.com/contest for your chance to win the ride of a lifetime in the greatest free show on earth, powered in part by Mercedes-Benz of Covington, Laissez-les Pontons Roulet with WWL. And don't forget that tonight, we are the home of the New Orleans Pelicans. The Pels take on the Sacramento Kings in the Smoothie King Center tonight. Pregame at 6:30, tip-off 7 p.m. on the Big 870 WWL. We spoke with Evan Holmes earlier, the general manager of the Superdome. They have a concert Friday night. They have two Pels games this week, and we talked about all of the things that need to be dismantled. I know they're still trying to get a lot of that equipment off of Poydras. Not certain when that is going to ultimately be completed. A lot of folks were asking about that. I'll try and get an answer to that question for you by tomorrow morning. Obviously, we have some bad weather coming in this evening, which is going to present a challenge for sure. All right, got to get to another break. We will be right back. We'll check in with Scoot to see what he has coming your way when we return. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. And Scoot joins us. He's headed your way. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
We're going to talk about the penny. The penny. Yeah, I've got a bunch of them at home. You got any pennies at home?
I got a bunch.
Yeah, you know,
maybe the value will go up.
Maybe so, because, you know, but, you know, I know everybody says they're kind of worthless and meaningless, but if you put five of them together, you got a nickel. If you get 25 of them, you got a quarter. So we're going to talk about the future of the nickel. President Trump wants to do away with the nickel. He also wants to, again, you know, cut government, the size of government. And I'm all for that. Also, Cardi B is blaming President Trump for ruining her $3,000 shoes at the Super Bowl. We've got that story. And some people are concerned about the mental health of Justin Bieber because of a possible breakup. Hell, I was worried about his mental health when I heard his first song. So, you know.
There's a whole bunch of them in that industry. I'm worried about their mental health.
A little bit about that coming up.
All righty. Scoot's headed your way with a great lineup, folks. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Wednesday evening, and we'll cover the Cullen,